Blog Talk Radio.
We are not alone. And welcome to another episode of Contact Radio, featuring Leslie Mitchell Clark and co-host Wes Roberts, where we explore ufology and beyond with the help of the world's foremost experts. And without further ado, here's your host and your guide, Leslie Mitchell Clark.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Wes Roberts sitting in very briefly for Leslie Mitchell Clark. We have a pre-tape, but we're suffering a little bit of slow bandwidth and slow upload tonight, so I've been at this for a little while. I expect the show to start in about 2 minutes, so my great apologies for the delay, but you are going to enjoy the show. Ms. Paula Bates will be on talking about her book and all about Atlantis. And so this was pre-recorded earlier, so we're sorry that you can't call in or join the chat room. And once again, as soon as this upload finishes to Blog Talk, I will run the show for you. So please stay tuned for another minute or two. Thank you.
We are not alone. And a very, very wonderful evening to all of our wonderful friends out there this almost spring evening. I tell you, we're really ready for spring here in the Northeast and throughout the Canadian and American Midwest. It's been bone chilling, but we're good for spring. I can sort of feel it beginning to happen. And, of course, with me this evening is, as always, my co-host, Mr. Wes Roberts. Good evening, Wes. How are you doing?
Hi, Leslie. I'm doing quite well, and I'm very happy about what you just talked about. After a few days of minus 25, this is very good.
And, you know, I'm going to play my little violin. As you know, Wes, during that horrendous cold snap, we did have a boiler outage at my home. And we're plunged into the sub-zeros for 3 days. But the good news is I didn't age, like, at all, the whole weekend.
You got some time back. Beautiful.
That's right. Who needs Botox? Just take out the heat in the wintertime, and you'll
That's
be
it.
Okay. Anyway, we are so excited. We have a wonderful guest for you this evening, folks. And I would remind you that this show is being pre-recorded. So unfortunately, on this episode of Contact, we're not going to be able to run the chat room or take listener calls. But we have some interesting announcements coming up very soon, which will allow us to be far more interactive. Anyway, our wonderful guest this evening is Paula Bates. And Paula is a noted author. She's here talking about one of her books. She's a visual artist, an intuitive counselor, and her story is very interesting. In 2002, at a Brian Weiss past life regression workshop, Paula Bates relived a past life in ancient Atlantis that shook her world. And as a result of this emotionally charged information from her remote past that just barreled through her psyche that day, her fascinating debut novel, The Atlantean Legacy, began to take form. And Paula has always been an explorer of the spiritual realm, so this is really nothing new. In fact, we're going to be talking about how she's most likely continuing on her path that is so evident in her book. So she's always been an explorer, and she has followed the path that Spirit has laid out before her. And her explorations have led her to study with a multitude of highly regarded teachers and mentors, including Starhawk, Sonia Jaquette, I have to ask her about that, and Brian Weiss, just to name a few. Now, in addition to being an author and a seeker, she is also a certified past life regressionist, past life regression therapist, a certified sixth sensory practitioner, an intuitive counselor, a licensed mental health counselor, a Reiki master, and, of course, a visual artist. So that is our little background about our wonderful guest this evening, Ms. Paula Bates, and we're going to be talking about her, well, mind-bending new book, or actually it's a republishing of her seminal tome, The Atlantean Legacy. So without further ado, I would very much like to welcome to the program Ms. Paula Bates. Paula, good evening.
Good evening. It's really nice to be here on your show. I'm really delighted about having this opportunity to talk to you.
Well, we are so excited to have you, and I must tell you, both Wes and myself had an opportunity to read this mind-opening work, The Atlantean Legacy, but perhaps, you know, you and I and Wes are all familiar with the past life regression process, but perhaps you could just sort of streamline a little bit about how this past life journey directly led to your incredible story that takes place in The Atlantean Legacy.
Yes, I'd love to share that. I was at Brian Weiss' workshop, I think you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
In 2002, it was soon after 9/11. It wasn't very far away from that time period. And this information, I didn't expect this at all. I had this information about Atlantis come through. I was just doing this workshop just kind of for fun. And I thought, oh, maybe I might get a past life in Greece or Rome or something. And this came through, and it was so intense. It was hit me so hard that I just felt like I had to pursue it and go with it. I couldn't let it go. It was just when I talked about it for months afterwards, I would just tear up, because what I got was that the very end of the Atlantis going down, and there were seven priestesses. We were all in this room, and we had these crystal implants in our heads, and we were able to manipulate energy, and it pulled us out of our bodies, and then we stood and watched Atlantis go down, and it was just, it was mind-boggling, and I can even feel it right now. I can feel the sadness and the tears and the overwhelmingness of it.
Indeed, and it's incredibly palpable. And I must say, and both Wes and I agreed on this, by the way, that the imagery, the structure of the society, the incredible details embracing technology and also ancient religious beliefs such as the Hieros Gaimos, all of these elements came together to really create a compelling and, for me, a deeply resonant experience. And in keeping with that idea, do you believe that this lifetime that you channeled into this literary form, do you believe that this is an accurate picture of life in Atlantis, that you've been able to really give us a glimpse into how things actually were at that time?
It feels accurate to me. That's all I can say in my opinion, it is accurate. I think that we all are going to have different aspects, or remember different aspects, those of us who have been there, and I know many, many, many of us have been there. Because, you know, even if you try to remember something in present time, if you have four or five different people see the same accident, everybody reports something different. I mean, it's mm-hmm. quite common. So how I see it is that I had this story and it came through my filters, but there's kind of a general storyline that I've found when I've done some research later, and I want to say as an aside, I tried not to do any research while I was writing this book because I wanted it to be clear. I wanted it to be my information coming through, but later I did do some more checking with Edgar Cayce, various things, and there were definitely overlays and overlaps of how I wrote it and how they saw it, or he saw it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, as you say, truth is plastic and subjective, and mm-hmm. as certainly as hypnotherapists and all of your wonderful disciplines, that is as you say, proven every day in the way that people recount events that they co-experienced. So, but for me personally, I found it highly resonant. Before we get into, I want to talk about fear-based thinking and some of the elements of the structure of the society that you portrayed in the novel and how they relate to our experience today. But just before you were going to be on the show, 2 days ago, I think it was, I had a vivid. I'm going to call it an image. It wasn't a dream, unless you could call it a waking dream, because it was really 3D Technicolor. And in this snippet of what I saw, I stepped out onto a balcony and was looking below me at not a European city, but there were Mediterranean elements, but parts of the structures looked to be almost Art Nouveau, for lack of a better term. And there were materials that looked more like cement or a polymer than they did like stone. So there were some really interesting differences. But every roof was tiled in a Mediterranean ceramic tile. So that was familiar. And my body was much taller than now. I'm not a very tall person. I'm maybe 5'3" on a good day. But I was tall and slender, and I had red hair. I'm normally blonde. And I was standing on this balcony on a perfect day, and I knew that I worked or ran some type of treatment clinic, if you will, and that it was over to my left. I even knew where it was in the city. And standing next to me, I had it felt like a servant, I'm sorry to say, and this person was of a darker ethnicity, looked more subcontinent, perhaps from India. And I saw some of my jewelry, and then that was the end. But it was very, very palatable, and was sort of incited after reading your book.
Oh, that's great. And that's what I'm hoping will happen, is other people will have, as people read it, they will have their own memories triggered, because we have so many memories from that time period. I mean, it's supposed to have lasted Atlantis, this civilization, around 200,000 years. So if that's true, then there were lots and lots of times, opportunities for us to be reincarnated into that lifetime many times. And I'm sure each of us has had more than one lifetime in that civilization.
Indeed, and not to mention even Lemuria that predated and coexisted for a time with Atlantis. We have other mass populations, and that was a multi-ethnic society. So people mm-hmm. have been around, and we're just really in our lifetime, we're really starting to see evidence of the deep antiquity of humanity by the findings of these massive skeletons in North America that defy logic, because they exist at a time when there should have been no humanoids. So we're going to see a lot of, I think, things come out that have supported what those of us who sort of travel in the arcane world have known for a long time. But I would love to talk about fears and fears of regression. And perhaps you could just talk to us a little bit about that, about what past life regression really is and how benign and therapeutic it actually is.
Oh, yes, it's really very relaxing in many ways. I mean, hypnosis gets you into a relaxed state, and then it allows you to open up your subconscious mind and to bring through information that's been there all along, but that has been submerged. One thing to remember when you're having a past life regression is that it already happened, and all you have to do is open your eyes and you're back in the room. But if you don't feel comfortable at all, like there's a lot of videos and things that you can work with online and that sort of thing, programs. But if you don't feel comfortable doing it, find a certified past life regressionist and work with that person. I personally prefer that for myself, to have somebody externally working with me, because that person can take you out of, if you're in a particularly grisly situation or something, that the therapist can pull you out of that situation and have you looking down. And that feels the most comfortable to me.
Yes. And really, you know, as we know, even when we're talking about, you know, the type of hypnosis you would do with childhood trauma in this lifetime, people do not need to relive the trauma in a real-time way, in a physical real-time way, to release it. That's one of the big discoveries of 21st century psychiatry, is that we know that it can be relieved and dismissed and processed and integrated without having to relive the event in a traumatic way. So that's a good thing for people to keep in mind, that you are still in control, even, you know, when you're under hypnosis. Nobody can make you do or experience anything that you don't want to, and it's a relieving process. Hypnosis is pleasurable. Wes, maybe you'd like to talk about how pleasurable hypnosis is for a minute.
Yeah, I'm just listening in here. For our audience and for our guest's sake, we should know that I've been through 30-plus sessions with Leslie over a series of 4 to 5 years. And we've explored an awful, awful lot about, let's call it, my alien connection, abduction experiences, and other experiences to do with otherworldly intelligences. Anyway, in my first session, I didn't know what to expect. I had meditated, and still do, for years. I was quite capable of altered states and various other mental states. So we went through this for the first time, and it was so unexpected how much consciousness one retains and how comfortable and relaxing the process is. So after several sessions, it's like I started to look forward to this. Not just some of the stuff we uncovered wasn't too pleasant, but most was very positive and very good for me, and changed my life, because I was able to sleep better and integrate various realities better. And as a college professor, I absolutely needed that. So hypnosis has always been a very comfortable thing for me.
Yes, and one other thing is that when people go into these past life regression trances, or they're trying to come up with a past life, oftentimes they'll have information that they already were familiar with, and they might poo-poo it, saying, oh, I already know that. But oftentimes that is the door and the opening into the memory.
Yes.
So you need, one of the things that you can learn to do as you do these regressions is to trust in the information that's coming and not second-guess it. And once you do that, it just flows, and it's just amazing. The details, the information that comes through, it really is mind-boggling and really, I think, fun.
Oh, gosh, it's endlessly fascinating, isn't it? And another endlessly fascinating thing about past life regression is, and I'm sure you probably do something like this, or we see it happen, that the client gets the information from the lifetime that they need to hear that correlates. You know, it seems randomized in a sense, yes, because unless you're giving a suggestion to go to a specific lifetime that you have some conscious memory of, it's kind of random, I think, or at least, you know, the way that I do it, and because I really, really trust that spirit or the person's higher consciousness will arrive at the lifetime that they need to hear about at that moment.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I like to do that in that way, too, and unless, of course, they have a specific thing, like you said. But that trusting, and it is amazing how they'll come up with something that really does line up with whatever their issues are that they're dealing with now, and it is fascinating, and it relieves that the tension or the charge around that concern.
Yes. Indra, and charge is really the right word, because we're really diffusing a kind of an electronic circuit of anger or negativity that is being held in the body, or at least kind of the way I think of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, I think.
Just diffuse, you can diffuse these reactivity points, because people will react. People can be highly reactive to stuff that is propelling them that they are completely unaware of. And hyper-reactivity is not going to make you very popular in the workplace or at home.
That's true. Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, now in your novel, boy, we'll have to, you know what, we're going to have to do a whole show just on regression sometime in the future, Paula, where we just focus on that, because there's so much that I would love to ask you. You're so experienced. But in your novel, there, the central character, well, it really rotates around, I guess, two sisters or a family group, if you want to extend that. Now, and this was a question both Wes and I had, in the novel, are you one of these sisters? Does one of these sisters carry your story?
Yes, it's Akana.
Ah.
And that's my, yeah. She's the one who I related to.
Mm-hmm. And do you see her visually in your mind? Do you have a visual image of what she looks like? I say beyond what's described in the book.
Yes. For one thing, she had an elongated skull, and the way I saw it was that there had been originally aliens from the Pleiadians. Who came originally to our planet, and they mated with the Earthlings, and they created this new race. And by the time I wrote the book, the timeline in the story, there really weren't any of the pure Pleiadians really left there on the planet. But one of the residual characteristics was the elongated skull. Now, Akana, I saw her as actually, she had darker skin and long, curly black hair. But there was a lot of different variations at that point. But she did have the elongated skull. And many of the people who were the priests and priestesses had the elongated skull. And the elongated skull gave them that ability, or there was something in that genetic part of having that allowed them to do certain skills that mm-hmm. other people couldn't do, you know, more intuitive and psychic and that sort of thing.
Yes, yes. Which is very, certainly this carried even into the early Egyptian kingdom, because of, you know, the elongated skulls are everywhere around the world,
mm-hmm.
and they're not the result of head binding or any other hydroencephalitis. They're not the result of anything but a unknown genome. And is it the Caracas skulls that are so recently being studied with DNA, and they found unknown DNA and unknown, this is a real thing, and I can imagine mm-hmm. that as the distillation of enlightened alien DNA got less and less, that there may have been more and more social divisions, and then we get into kind of the maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about the societal structure of the period of Atlantis that this story takes place in.
Well, originally there was a lot of genetic manipulation where they created a race of slaves, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually kind of backfired. And the original humans started kind of attacking on the outskirts of Atlantis. And so they figured that they needed to have soldiers. So they created a race of genetically enhanced soldiers, which actually ended up creating their enemies,
mm-hmm.
that because they eventually left. Anyway, it was so there was a race of slaves, and that was part of the society. People had household help,
yeah,
that sort of thing. Yeah.
So they had manipulated, there had been genetic manipulation, not only, this is really very in keeping. I'm not sure how you feel about this, but in the work of Zechariah Sitchin, where he discusses the Anunnaki, and all of this is really not in conflict with anything that you are saying, because there is a large belief system that that Poseidon or Poseidia, which was the capital city of Atlantis, was actually the home base of Enki, one of the two original controllers, genetic manipulators, one benevolent, the other not, but that Atlantis was in fact in the bigger picture, city of the gods, the place where the Anunnaki, where Enki, or at least made his home base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not real familiar with that story, mm-hmm. so I can't really speak to it at all.
Well, it's certainly sometime, if you ever get a chance, there's a wonderful, I think the best one is called The Lost Book of Enki, and it's a mm-hmm. really easy read, and it's fascinating, and it's Zechariah Sitchin, who's passed away, was the author. They're called is it the 12th Planet series? There are a number of books, but at any rate. But what you're talking about cuts across just the, really embraces many people's philosophy that, in fact, there was this infusion of alien DNA, and that it did result in these tall, long-skulled, psychokinetic, telepathic people, and that as things diminished, so did the society. So anyway, tell us a little bit about how that society functioned. Was there money? I know the answer, but tell us about the money system. It's very Gene Roddenberry-esque. I love it.
Yeah. How what I saw was that they actually had developed a chip that they had implanted in babies when they were born, and the chip controlled a lot of things about them, but it created a lot of safety things for them. They were protected by the government. They had all their monetary needs taken care of. It would be like like having an iPhone in your wrist. And you tap it, and you get it, the information that would come up and such. But one of the things it did control also was their sexuality. And one of the things that the Atlantean society at one point had been very aware of was that they that their sexuality was a way to connect to the divine. And as regular people, citizens, became more kind of overtaken by their own fears and their own needs for security, the government used that as a way to get in and control the people themselves.
Hmm. And so this sexuality, now in the book, the chip pulls off the activation of someone's sexual activity until it is released by a specific ceremony or rite, which sounds an awful lot like the ancient rite of Hieros Gaimos.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what happened. And as the book is taking place, there are many people who are starting to question whether that's really a good thing to have that kind of control. The people had accepted that kind of control because it kept things from happening, like sexual abuse to children, there were so many things that they wanted to control, so many fear-based things around sexuality, and they wanted to keep it all in that beautiful sacred realm. But at the same time, it was taking away a part of their freedom. So they were beginning to rebel, and that was part of what was happening.
Mm-hmm. I see. And so this is really, you could say that this book about this period of time in Atlantis with governmental control, the haves and the have-nots, people of widely different intellectual abilities, widely different gifts, all trying to coexist together in a meaningful way, this really resonates with our contemporary society.
Mm-hmm. It does, and it also resonates with the fear part, that people are wanting to do more and more things to protect themselves, and wanting to have the government take care of themselves and take care of them by building walls and various different things. We won't go into that, but
yeah, lunatic things.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's where there is a definite overlap. At least I see it. One of the things about the book, the Legacy of Atlantis, I believe, is if you see the mistakes you've made in the past, then you can perhaps keep yourself from stepping into those. And that's one of the things I was hoping with this book. It might, you know, trigger some things for people.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And even if you completely are ambivalent about the idea of past life regression, this is a wonderful story, and with a lot of meaningful metaphors and parallels to our contemporary time. So it's enjoyable. You don't have to accept everything that we're saying today to enjoy this wonderful book. I just wanted to bring that out because it could be a screenplay. You know, have you thought about that, Paula?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I'm really open to that.
It's written in such a clear linear way that it would I think it would convert easily into cinematic form.
In fact, that's one of my big hopes. The book, beyond the past life regression, the rest of the book feels like it was channeled. It feels like it was given to me, mm-hmm. and that actually, as I'm doing different interviews and stuff about the book, I'm finding out what's in the book too. Because, I mean, I know what's in the book, but at the same time, people are saying, well, what did you mean by that, or why did you put that in there? And really, I don't know. I'm learning, too, because it feels like this was given to me to be put out there in the world, and that it was something that I came here to do. And you were asking about Sonia Choquette earlier. You know, I've done several trainings with her, so that now I'm the sixth sensory intuitive certified, and I've done several readings with her and that sort of thing. And one of the things she said when I was talking about the book to her, and she said, yeah, Paula, that's what you've come here to do, and that's what I feel like I have come here to do. And so many things synchronistically have lined up for this book that it's just mind-boggling to me. And I never planned to write. I never considered myself an author. And all of a sudden, I have a book it's been birthed to me, and I'm to give to the world. So here I am doing that.
Yeah, there you are. And that is, it's interesting, too, that you are also, I mean, you're obviously being a visual artist as well. Maybe that's one of the reasons why your book is written in such a visceral, visual way, at least from my perspective, because you see all this stuff and you're able to convey the visual aspects of every scene so clearly. And I think that some authors are not that visual. You know, it's all about feelings, but you combined, I think, your various talents that you've come into this lifetime with.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I really do appreciate that. That the visuals in the book were really important to me. In fact, that's how the book was given to me. It was given to me after I got the initial information from the Brian Weiss workshop. And did a few other past life regressions to enhance that information. Then I sat down in front of the computer and played the music and just kind of ensconced myself in this little cocoon and just let the information come. And as it came in pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to write it out in my own style of writing, but I had to write it out, and that's how it came. And so it was really fun to write because I didn't have to struggle for the story at all.
Right.
I mean, that the whole plot just laid out for me.
It did, and being a visual processor, primarily, that's the way you got the information. So that's fascinating, and it's endlessly fascinating the way people process information, isn't it? Because they can be kinesthetic, they can be audio, or some combination of both, and so that may be one of the reasons why reality is plastic and subjective, is because we are all processing it in slightly different ways.
I mean, all are totally different. I mean, each person is so different, and I know it sounds really trite to say that, but it's really true.
Oh, they are.
Really true. We each have our own little take on it. And with my book, that's how I've had people react to it. Various people are affected by various parts of the book, and there's various parts that speak to them. So it's very interesting to see what part pulls one person in and what part pulls another person in. I love that.
It's fantastic. Wes, you must be chomping at the bit at the virtual bit over there. I'm sure you have a couple of questions for Paula, particularly with your own interest in Egyptology.
Actually, I have probably too many comments, so I'll edit that down.
You're self-editing. That is a wonderful quality in a co-host.
So a couple of things. One thing is, Paul, and I don't know how you feel about this reference, is that you remind me of the work that Barbara Marciniak has done with respect to the Palladians. And I have her first four books and have actually only gone through the first one so far, in the sense that it's channeled information. And the other thing is, you paint such a picture from that perspective, not from today's perspective. And that's really important to me. And that reminds me of some of the work of the De Lubitzes when they wrote about ancient Egypt.
And you're naming names of people I don't know. Isn't that interesting? Because I really have not done a lot of reading about it. I mean,
well,
I've done some, and mostly with Edgar Casey and that sort of thing. But it's really interesting to hear different names. And I'm going to have you give those to me later. So
Not a problem. And in fact, I can draw a very brief context around those two things. Barbara Marciniak has written channeled information about the Palladians, and there are several volumes of it, and it's purported to come directly from the Palladians. So it's fascinating stuff, and when I read her first book, I thought this book was written to me specifically. That's how well done it was, and your book reminds me of that. So that's the Marciniak connection. And then the De Lubitzes wrote all sorts of heavy-duty stuff about ancient Egyptian civilization from the standpoint of the ancient Egyptian, as if you're walking down the path and up to the temple from their standpoint in that time frame. And they're the De Lubitzes husband and wife team. So I can certainly email this to you, but those are the things that are affecting me right now.
Oh, well, and I take that as quite a compliment that you compare my work to those authors. That's wonderful.
Oh, well intentioned. Absolutely. When I was reading your book, I thought, wow, and these things came to mind, and I mentioned these to Leslie as an aside, and we don't have to dwell on them in the show right now, but there they are.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. And Paula, where with all of this information that you've channeled and your own experiences with the regression to this Atlantean time, where do you think Atlantis was actually located?
Well, I think it was located between Europe and Africa and North and South America,
mm-hmm.
and it's like sort of maybe the shape of Australia-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part that went down, the part that was in my story, was closer to the Bimini Islands,
yes,
in that area there.
Yes. Which has a very thick atmosphere, by the way. I don't know if you've spent much time down there. I've been there quite a few times, and it's kind of magical. And just as Edgar Casey said, more and more ruins are being discovered that are in deep antiquity, and we now have the capability to date them in a better way than carbon dating. So I have no doubt that that we may find some sort of definitive thing, and probably went all the way from there to, there's some talk that Ireland would have been the one of the attachment points in Europe, and indeed, and probably, I guess, where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is might represent the width, the biggest part of the landmass, I would think, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know about it attaching to Ireland or not, but could possibly. I really didn't get that kind of information in the book, but it's a lot of people think that that was one of the places where the Atlanteans migrated to, was Ireland and that area over there, mm-hmm. as well as Egypt and various places in North and South America and around.
Indeed. And, you know, without really giving away, you know, the end of your book or anything like that, can you tell us a little bit about what happens to the society during the arc of your story?
Well, at one point they realize that the island's going to be destroyed, so they begin to, the civilization as a whole, or the people that are there on Atlantis, choose places to go, and they go around, they leave. But there's a mass, everyone leaves, and they go to, oh, not everyone, there's a group of people that are left on the island, but mostly everyone leaves, and there's a mass exodus to the various colonies that had already been established for many over the world. So they chose where to go.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of these, where would some of these colonies then have been located? We mentioned possibly Ireland, but where else do you feel the Atlantean people were able to escape to?
Egypt, for sure. Mm-hmm. That was the big one. That's where the main heads of the country went to reestablish themselves. Mm-hmm. But there was also various places in South America, Peru, I imagine. I think where some of the different ruins are in that are pyramid shaped in, like, you know, around Cancun and areas like that in Mexico and. Mm-hmm. I think maybe even in various places in the North American continent.
Indeed. They may have made it, you know, to... there were a number of massive skeletons discovered on Catalina Island that is just a you know, hop and skip and a hop from, say, Los Angeles, San Pedro Harbor, like that. Catalina Island is... it's one of the Channel Islands. There are a few of them, and I think they've found some evidence on all three. But Catalina Island, many, many large skeletons with elongated skulls were recovered. And unfortunately, and we've talked about this on the show before, but the Smithsonian Institution had possession of maybe even thousands of these skeletons, and they were ordered, or there was one particular, what's the word for someone who... docent or someone who was active in the museum was ordered to incinerate the skeletons, and that was in fact done, and that individual gave a deathbed confession about what they had been asked to do on behalf of the Smithsonian, because these large skeletons do not fit in to the prescribed narrow-minded archaeological pedagogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I've hit up against with in my own reading and stuff of the, like in Egypt, and the traditional Egyptologists are so close-minded to the ideas and the age of the pyramids and the age of the Sphinx. I mean, it's so obvious from the watermarks and that sort of thing that that they're so much older than anybody says, and you know, if you see any of these shows that have the different monuments, old monuments, and how they're so precise, and they could have only been cut with some kind of really high technological tool.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, it's so mind-boggling that this stuff is thrown away and thrown away and thrown away.
It is on a certain level, but there is awareness. There are shows like Ancient Aliens, my friend Giorgio Tsoukalos is right. I mean, there is a shift, a paradigm shift, I think, about to occur, which is why the standard school of thought is clinging on with their cold, dead hands to these antiquated ideas. You know, the work of Graham Hancock is absolutely phenomenal. He was he was the first guy who really challenged the timeline and talked about the water damage on the Sphinx and all of these other things. And there's something going on in Egypt where I think that they have a sort of a nationalistic deal going where they don't want to express the idea that anybody other than, 10 million Egyptians in diapers, hauled those bricks up and created the pyramids. They are so resistant, and they keep putting people in charge of the antiquities that are slightly to the right of Attila the Hun. I mean, this guy, Dr. Zawas, completely ignored, and even there's some evidence he may have even desecrated or prevented certain historical things from coming to light. But right now there is a huge thing going on with archaeologists from all over the world because there's radiograms, there's ground penetrating radar, just as Edgar Cayce predicted, has been used to monitor, the vicinity around the pyramids and the Sphinx, and there's a massive tunnel network running underground between all of these structures and large rooms, apparently caverns. So may we not still find some records of Atlantis that were preserved as Edgar Cayce said they were? I think it's highly possible, but it's a fight going on right now. The Egyptians themselves are preventing further research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do have a sequel to this book, and that's where they go into Egypt. I do get into a little bit in the pyramids and things that are happening in there, and the rooms, some of the rooms that were in there, and evidently there was supposed to have been a room that stored information from like various civilizations that had already passed before Atlantis even. As just interesting information that now that was not channeled. That was actually information I read somewhere, which really resonated with me that I put in there. But it's just fascinating, and I just can't wait for all this to come out.
It's going to happen because people, human beings, we are endlessly curious. That is one thing, that is a commonality of all people on the globe. We are curious people. And so I cannot imagine anyone letting go of this line of pursuit. We need to rediscover our own history before we have to go through this terrible cycle again, which maybe we can still avoid. So that's fantastic. And hopefully in our lifetime, we're going to see a lot of this information validated by historical evidence. Now, when you were experiencing your regression, and this is a question that I often get, you probably do too. When you were reliving, now you said mostly the images were visual and you were writing them down, but at any point did you have a chance in your regression or in your further work to see the form of writing that maybe these people used, or hear a bit of the original language? Certainly the names, some of them sound very Egyptian.
Yes, a little bit. I call the main character's name is Akana, but it's really Akana.
It's
pronounced Akana. It seems like everybody who's read it has grabbed onto Akana, so I've just gone with that. But Akana is really what it was. Now, there is a CD that is put out. It's not my CD, it's Friend's CD. There's three musicians, fabulous musicians, who read my book, sat down, and channeled the music in 3 hours, and it is gorgeous. It has harps, toning, crystal bowls, and one of the women, Kim Taylor, has channeled an ancient language. It was just supposed to be the Atlantean language in it, and it's just beautiful. And I have actually, if you don't mind me saying this now, there's a place where you can go and download a couple cuts from the CD that I could give you.
Wonderful. Please tell us.
So that's at my website, which is paulabates.com. paulbates.com. And for this particular thing, it would be paulbates.com/Atlantean Music/.
Wonderful.
So you can go there and download a couple songs, and they're just beautiful. Just beautiful.
I'm sure they are. And you know, I would well imagine that the Atlantean language, being, you know, one of our root languages, may have even had a lot of what we interpret as Sanskrit in it now, because Sanskrit roots are found far and wide. They're found in Gaelic, in the Gaelic language. They're found in the language that is spoken by the Basque people. This group of languages, there had to have been some type of diaspora, because people just coming across the Bering Straits doesn't explain it.
No, it doesn't explain it at all. No. So much more to it. And the language did sound a little bit Arabic or
yes.
something like that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I think Aramaic maybe.
Aramaic.
Yeah, I think maybe Aramaic does also have acknowledged Sanskrit roots. So it's fascinating. The study of languages could probably really tell us everything if we opened our minds. Because language, just like DNA, gets passed in a fascinating way from culture to culture, either through necessity or through just contact. It happens. It's part of our curiosity and our need to communicate. Now, Paula, are there any other lifetimes that you've explored in your past life journeys that you are thinking of perhaps channeling into more of this kind of material?
Well, I do have some past lives that I am thinking about, but I'm not far enough along to really go there. But it is like a continuation of the reincarnation of this person, Akana.
Mm.
Akana.
So it's your soul journey going through different lifetimes.
Yes. And it reconnects up to some of the Atlantean things.
Are there people in your present time life, your family, your friends, your soul group, are there people that you recognize as having been with you in the life that you have explored in this novel?
Yeah, I found one or two people. I've found a lot of people who say they've been in Atlantis, but there's only been like two people that I really feel like were really there with me.
Would one of those have been your sister? Did she show up anywhere in your present time life, or your parents?
No.
Ah.
No, it was the Kahotep.
Ah. Interesting. Very interesting. That's the whole idea of soul groups and incarnating with different members of our family to learn the lessons that we need to do. I'm certain you must have seen quite a bit of evidence of that in your own work as a regressionist. You know, I will often ask people if they recognize anyone from that lifetime, and invariably there's somebody that they recognize. Sometimes a lot of people.
Yeah, it's true. And oftentimes you recognize them by their eyes.
Mm. Because the eyes will remain the same. In the Atlantean life, was it, you said there were people of various, were there people, in fact, that were racially different? In other words, you saw people of darker skin, I know, but were there different racial groups of people involved in Atlantis as they were in allegedly Lemuria?
Yes, there were. Like in the story, the several of the students, they came from all over the world, actually, to train there, and one of her best friend, Lila, was a redhead with, you know, really light skin, and I think she came more from the area of Ireland and over there, and then she herself was very dark, and they were very close, but they were very contrasting in their looks.
Yes. So there was people from the known world were all moving about
mm-hmm.
here, most certainly.
Yes.
Fascinating. And Wes, did you have something you wanted to ask Paula?
Well, I'm always fascinated in what I refer to as subtext. interplay between the characters, their overt communication, which we can read in your book, and what's behind that overt communication. I wonder if that's how it occurred to you. What was behind it? You know, the transmission of the feelings and the transmission of intent.
I'm not quite sure where you're going with that question, but I didn't think it through that much when I wrote it. It was mm-hmm. just handed to me, and I just wrote it down as it came, and that's the story. So as I read it later on, you can see various things going on between the characters and like how Akana has to grow up because mm-hmm. she's coming from a place of being very sheltered. She doesn't know any of the things that have been going on in the mm-hmm. government behind everybody's back and the control things that have been happening, and she finds out all that. And then there's just various things like her teacher, who she ends up being lovers with, and all the things he has to do to decide whether to or what to do when they know that the island is going down. But like I said, I didn't think it through as a subtext or whatever. It's just like, this is just how it was given to me.
Probably.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Wes.
No, I was just going to say, probably where I'm coming from, Paul, is just that there's a lot of emotion in the book, and the emotion is partly transmitted by the words that you wrote. And to me, it's layers and layers more than that. So that's where I was going with that.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad I was able to do that. It was an emotional story for me. It was totally emotional, and I cried, and I was in that world for so long while I was writing it, and I really did want to transmit those emotions into the pages. And I thank you. It seems like I was able to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you were. And I think it was just such a direct translation. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel as if you were processing through the language through a bunch of filters. Like, you know, I speak Spanish, but if I'm going to say something in Spanish, I have to think about, well, you know, I have to think about it, you know, because the English comes first, obviously. But you seem to just, when you tap into the soul memory, and I'm sure you find this, I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier, I often get the question, well, if somebody lived a life in France and they're recalling their life as a, you know, a French, you know, a resistance fighter and, you know, during the Napoleonic year, why aren't they speaking in French when they go into that past life? And I guess my answer to that question is, well, sometimes they do. You know, once in a great while, though, but it's far more common that they just speak directly